11. What's wrong with memes? Objections and replies. Memes don't exist. On a number of occasions when I have encountered hostility to memes, I have been treated to a haughty sneer. Memes? Memes? Can you prove to me that memes even exist? Claims about non-existence are almost always slippery, especially when scientists wax philosophical or philosophers wax scientific. We can all agree, can't we, that mermaids and poltergeists and phlogiston and élan vital don't exist, but controversies simmer in some quarters over genes, strings of string theory, public languages as contrasted with idiolects, numbers, colors, free will, qualia, and even dreams. Sometimes the negative claims are based on a highly austere doctrine of reality according to which nothing really exists except atoms and the void, or subatomic particles and physical fields, or just one subatomic particle dashing back and forth between the beginning of time and the end of time, weaving a fabric with itself. A proposal by the physicist John Archibald Wheeler. Both philosophers and scientists have long been attracted to such minimalist visions. As a student of mine once noted, Parmenides is the philosopher who said, "There is just one thing, and I'm not it." Sometimes the sweeping negative claims encompass all of the manifest image. The items in the official ontology of the scientific image really exist, but solid objects, colors, sunsets, rainbows, love, hate, dollars, home runs, lawyers, songs, words, and so on, don't really exist. They are useful illusions, perhaps, like the user illusion of the desktop icons. The patterns of colored pixels on the computer screen are real, but they portray entities that are as fictional as Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse. Similarly, some would say the manifest image has some reality as a collection of images, the movie we live in, perhaps, but it is a mistake to think of the things we interact with and manipulate and fall in love with as reality. That's a defensible position, I suppose. In fact, it's a version of what I have said about the manifest image of each species, a user illusion brilliantly designed by evolution to fit the needs of its users. My version differs only in being willing and eager to endorse these ontologies as ways of carving up reality, not mere fictions, but different versions of what actually exists, real patterns. The more shocking way of saying it, we live in a fictional world, in a dream world, in unreality, tends to cause confusion because it suggests we are somehow victims, duped by some evil force. Some theorists deny that, say, dollars exist, but have no difficulty accepting love, hate, and rainbows. The reality of love, hate, and rainbows is never mentioned, however, since it is obvious to them that these exist, but not obvious to them that dollars exist. Setting aside such radical metaphysical doctrines, usually what is meant by denying that X's exist is that some theory or other of X's is a bad theory. When the theory is a folk theory drawn from the manifest image, this is often undeniable. For instance, the folk theory of color is rife with error and confusion. But does that mean that colors don't really exist? Are we as deluded about colors as we would be about mermaids if we believed in them? Some would say that. Others are less willing to go down that path. Should Sony be sued for false advertising for claiming to sell color television sets? An intermediate position declares that colors don't really exist, but acting as if they do is a useful fiction. Yet another option insists that colors do indeed exist. They just aren't what the folk think they are. I have followed that path throughout my career, insisting that not only are colors real, but also consciousness, free will, and dollars. Dollars are an interesting case. Probably one of the most powerful subliminal supports for the belief in the reality of dollars comes from the undoubted existence of dollar bills and coins. Legal tender you can see and weigh and manipulate and carry around. Bitcoin, in contrast, seems much more illusory to most folks, but if they reflect on it, they will discover that the palpable, foldable dollar bills that are physical objects are ontological crutches of sorts, to be thrown away once you've learned how to walk, leaving in place only the mutual expectations and habits that can, in principle, support Bitcoin as well as dollars. Well into the 20th century, there were heated political debates on the necessity of maintaining such crutches, the gold standard and silver certificates and the like. But tomorrow's children may grow up with only credit cards to hold and manipulate and be none the worse off for it. Dollars are real, they just aren't what you may think they are. Consciousness exists, but just isn't what some folks think it is. And free will exists, but it is also not what many think it must be. I have learned, however, that some people are so sure that they know what consciousness or free will would have to be real, that they dismiss my claims as disingenuous. They claim I'm trying to palm off a cheap substitute for the real thing. For instance, of course the problem here is with the claim that consciousness is identical to physical brain states. The more Dennett et al. Try to explain to me what they mean by this, the more convinced I become that what they really mean is that consciousness doesn't exist. Dennett doesn't establish the kind of absolute free will and moral responsibility that most people want to believe in and do believe in. That can't be done, and he knows it. According to my theories, consciousness is not a non-physical phenomenon, and free will is not a phenomenon isolated from causation. And by the lights of Wright and Strawson and others, I ought to have the courage then to admit that neither consciousness nor free will really exists. Perhaps I could soften the blow by being a fictionalist, insisting that they don't really exist, but it is remarkably useful to act as they did. I don't see why my critics think their understanding about what really exists is superior to mine, so I demur. What I should say about memes is, in any case, easier. The theory I am defending declares, non-metaphorically and literally and without caveat, that words are memes that can be pronounced. Memes exist because words are memes, and words exist, and so do other ways of doing things that are transmitted non-genetically. If you are one of those who wants to deny that words exist, you will have to look elsewhere for a rebuttal, since I am content, without further argument, to include all the furniture of the manifest image, words very much included in my ontology. Now let's consider the substantive objections to the theory of memes I am defending. Memes are described as discrete and faithfully transmitted, but much in cultural change is neither. Richardson and Boyd, while sympathetic to many of Dawkins's claims, resist calling any cultural information item a meme because of its connotations as a discrete, faithfully transmitted gene-like entity, and we have good reason to believe that a lot of culturally transmitted information is neither discrete nor faithfully transmitted. We've already seen that words really are quite discrete, faithfully transmitted entities, and they are at least somewhat gene-like. Or better, genes are somewhat word-like, as we heard in Chapter 8, in Dawkins's analogy with the Mac toolbox of subroutines. In one respect, the analogy with words is misleading. Words are shorter than genes, and some writers have likened each gene to a sentence. But sentences aren't a good analogy for a different reason. Different books are not put together by permuting a fixed repertoire of sentences. Most sentences are unique. Genes, like words but unlike sentences, are used over and over again in different contexts. A better analogy for a gene than either a word or a sentence is a toolbox subroutine in a computer. Words are like genes, then, in being informational structures, like subroutines, that determine ways of doing things. Richardson and Boyd are right that a lot of culturally transmitted information is neither discrete nor faithfully transmitted, as we shall see. So, perhaps their objection, applied to the view here, is that memes are only a small, maybe a minor part of the information that cultural evolution discovers and refines. Suppose words were the only memes, or almost the only memes, then memetics or the meme's eye perspective could hardly be considered a general theory of cultural evolution. Similarly, Dan Sperber, another serious critic of memes, defines memes as cultural replicators propagated through imitation, and acknowledges that while a few such entities exist, he mentions chain letters but ignores words as examples, they represent a minuscule fraction of cultural transmissions. For memetics to be a reasonable research program, it should be the case that copying and differential success in causing the multiplication of copies overwhelmingly plays the major role in shaping all or at least most of the contents of culture. I think that this is too strong a demand, and I anticipate that Sperber might well agree, given his vacillation between overwhelmingly and or at least most of the contents of culture. In any case, are words the only good memes? Even if they were, we might still find that the reliance on these memes for cumulative culture like ours gives the meme's eye view a dominant place in theories of cultural evolution, however small a portion of transmitted information was in the form of words. But in fact, there are more high-fidelity replicators in human culture than these critics have acknowledged, and they all depend, in one way or another, on some variety of digitization rather like phonemes, which, you will recall, create tokens that are subjectively similar, immediately identifiable, uncontroversially categorizable, in spite of their huge physical differences, thanks to evolved features of the human auditory system and vocal tract. The descendant tokens of cat are not physical replicas of their ancestors, but they are, we might say, virtual replicas, dependent on a finite system of norms to which speakers unconsciously correct their perceptions and their utterances. And this, not physical replication, is what is required for high-fidelity transmission of information. We see the same sort of abstraction and the same correction to the norm in music. I'll consider Western tonal music, the theory of which is better known to me and most of the likely listeners of this book. Nobody invented tonal music, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, but many musicians and music theorists contributed to codifying it and choosing the syllables to sing for each tone and perfecting a system of musical notation, a fine mixture of Darwinian cultural evolution and intelligent design over hundreds of years, beginning in the 11th century. Tonal music is a good example of a digitized alphabet that allows correction to the norm. You're singing that note a bit sharp. Fix it. Many musical innovations involve bending, sliding, deliberately flatting the notes, for instance in the blues, but standing behind these deviations are the canonical tones. Can you sing or hum the melody of Greensleeves, the same tune as the Christmas carol, What Child Is This? If you can, you are making another in a very long lineage of tokens of that melody, which is not in any particular key or at any particular tempo. Greensleeves, played at breakneck speed by a bebop saxophonist in C minor, is a token of the same type as Greensleeves played pensively on a guitar in E minor. If the ancient melody were not in the public domain, its copyright would cover it in any key, at any tempo, by any voice, or on any instrument. A collection of audible events with precious little physical similarity, but readily detectable identity in melody world, an important part of our manifest image. And, of course, this melody can now readily be written down in musical notation, which preserves it today much the way writing preserves the ancient orally transmitted sagas. But still, independently of musical notation, the unwritten systems of scales, like the systems of language before writing was invented, was itself a sufficient digitization to preserve simple melodies and harmonies by ear. In literature, there are still higher levels of abstraction that yield high-fidelity tokening of types. Not only do two different printings, in different fonts perhaps, of Moby Dick count as copies of the same novel, but so do translations into other languages. If not, could you claim to have read Homer's Iliad or Tolstoy's War and Peace? Translation is a process that requires comprehension, at least until Google Translate was developed, but that doesn't prevent reliable transmission from leaping over the language barrier, permitting global spread of cultural items that preserve many important features with high fidelity. Such examples show that beyond simple physical replicahood, there are a variety of higher levels of abstract similarity that can preserve information through selection events, permitting cultural evolution by natural selection to occur without succumbing to the error catastrophe described in Chapter 7. West Side Story is a descendant of Romeo and Juliet, not because the sequence of ink marks or sounds that compose Shakespeare's play are physically replicated, but because the sequence of circumstances and relationships portrayed are copied, a purely semantic-level replication. To paraphrase the familiar disclaimer, any resemblance between the characters in West Side Story and the characters in Romeo and Juliet is not purely coincidental. If you wonder that if such semantic replication counts as meme replication, recall that memes are informational structures that are normally valuable. They are worth copying, and copyright laws have been devised and refined to protect that value. Not only translations, faithful or not, but also abridgments, cinematic treatments, plays and operas based on novels, and even video games can count as meme replications. Given copyright laws, you can't take a novel about fictional folks in 19th century Boston and change all the names of the characters and set the novel in 18th century Paris and expect to get away with it. That is plagiarism, theft of design, even though the physical object that counts as the copy need share no distinctive physical properties at all with the source object. What is particularly important in this exploration of memes is that some of these higher levels really do depend on comprehension, not just copying competence, even though they are based on, and rely on, systems of copying competence that do not require comprehension. In fact, from this vantage point, we can see that the high-fidelity copying of DNA, our chief model for replication, stands out as an extreme case of mindlessness in replication. To get high-fidelity replication at the molecular level, using macromolecular structures, polymerase molecules and ribosomes, for instance, as the readers or copyists, you have to rely on dead simple copying, pretty much atom for atom recognition and subsequent duplication. At higher levels, with more sophisticated, more competent readers, you can create systems that can tolerate more physical variation. Spoken words are the chief example here, but there are others. Scrambled words are easily unscrambled. Turing saw the importance of basing his great invention on as mindless a recognition system as he could imagine. Binary choices between 0 and 1, whole, no whole in a piece of paper, or high voltage, low voltage between 2 points in a circuit. In principle, high fidelity transmission could be accomplished in a binary code that used love letters for 0 and death threats for 1. But you'd need readers capable of comprehension to get reliable transmission. This is possible in principle, and so are countless other digitization schemes, but do they actually play much of a role in human culture? In fact, they do. Computer programmers have an excellent jargon term, the thinko. A thinko is like a typo, a typographical error, but at a higher semantic level. Misthinking, not miswriting. Typing PRITN instead of PRINT is a typo. Forgetting to put the brackets or asterisks or whatever the programming language calls for around a comment is a thinko, and so is defining a three-place function where you need a four-place function. The notorious Y2K bug, which didn't leave room in data structures for dates that didn't begin with 19, was no typo. It was a thinko. A thinko is a clear mistake in any endeavor where the assumed goals of the enterprise require certain identifiable best practices. Bugs in computer programs may be attributable to typos in the source code, but more often they are thinkos. Most typos are spotted by the compiler program and sent back to the programmer for correction before the construction of executable code. If a falling short is not uncontroversially identifiable by the experts, it is perhaps a lamentable lapse, but not a thinko. A thinko is like an error in baseball. You get charged with an error, a substandard execution of a play, when there is uncertainty about what the best play would have been, or when a play is regrettable because it wasn't as spectacular as it might have been. It is not an error. What matters for high-fidelity replication is the existence of canons of practice relative to which thinkos can be routinely corrected. Truman Capote once dismissed a draft short story submitted for his approval with, "This isn't writing, this is typing." But he was not presumably identifying a thinko. He was displaying a standard of excellence that could not be routinely met by best practices. Routines are themselves memes, honed by differential replication over the generations, and composable into larger practices that can be read and written by experts. Making arrows and axes, tending fires, cooking, sewing, weaving, making pots and doors and wheels and boats, and setting out fishnets are ways that can be corrected over many generations by the combined action of simple physical requirements and local traditions. When these local traditions evolve into simple alphabets of moves, they provide a host of thinkos, cookos, weevos, and other readily correctable errors so that the traditions can be transmitted reliably, perhaps without language. This is an issue for Chapter 13. And as usual, nobody has to understand that such alphabets have this benefit, certainly not the memes that are the direct beneficiaries. A tradition composed of bad habits, parasitic reducers of human fitness, that happens to get digitized in this way will outlive its competition in the replication contest, other things being equal. Dance provides some interesting variations on these themes. Compare folk dancing with sophisticated choreography. Folk dancing typically has an alphabet well known to the folk who do the dances. In square dancing and contra dancing, for instance, there are a small number of named basic moves that everybody knows. The caller can create a new dance on the spot by just changing the order of the moves or their values. Honor your partner, honor your corner, gents to the center with a right-hand star, swing your partner and promenade her home. It's a dead simple programming language for contra dance construction. As a result of this digitized system, people who haven't danced a Virginia reel for decades, none of whom can remember just how it goes, can nevertheless partner up and recreate the dance with only a few rehearsals, replications, since majority rule will rinse out the typos or thinkos, missteps, restoring the original spelling of the dance. No two couples will do the allemande left in exactly the same way, but their variants will be acceptable fillers for the same role in the dance. Such voting has been reinvented again and again in human culture, and it is a reliable way of enhancing fidelity of transmission via unreliable, low-fidelity individual memories. Unison chanting is ubiquitous in traditional religions and other ceremonies, and it similarly serves to repair the memories of the chanters, none of whom could provide a faithful copy of last year's rendition unaccompanied. When chronometers were invented in the 18th century, navigators knew to take three, not two, chronometers on their long voyages, so that the majority rule trick, by then a recognized domesticated meme, could be used. The replicative power of tribal chanting didn't have to be recognized or appreciated by the chanters, though some reflective folks may well have caught on. Free-floating rationales have been as ubiquitous in cultural evolution as in genetic evolution, and as informative to us as theorists, once we manage to suppress our traditional habit of attributing comprehension to any organisms, or memes, observed to be doing something clever. Sophisticated choreography, in contrast with folk dancing, requires subtleties that demand a more expressive system of recipes. And while cinema and video recording has solved the problem by brute force, much the way recorded music can solve the problem of a missing musical score, choreography, in spite of its name to date, has lacked a system of graphing dance moves that is effective enough to go to fixation among dancers and choreographers. Labanotation, invented in the 1920s by Rudolf Laban, and refined and supplemented over the years, has its loyal core of aficionados, but has not yet established itself as the lingua franca of dance. It is tempting to see a gradual transition from 1. Infectious rhythmic entrainment among tribespeople dancing and noisemaking and vocalizing in impromptu gatherings, repeating their favorite moves and imitating each other, the synanthropic origins of dance requiring no leaders, no callers, no choreographers. 2. Through more self-conscious rituals, with rehearsal required and deliberate teaching and correcting, the domestication of dance with careful control of reproduction. 3. To today's professional choreographers, mimetic engineers, intelligently designing their art objects and launching them hopefully into the cultural world. The original ways of dancing, on this view, were memes that nobody owned, mindlessly evolving to exploit human idiosyncrasies of skeleton, gait, perception, and emotional arousal. What were they good for? For thriving in human company, habits that spread because they could spread, like the common cold. It would help, of course, if the original dance memes offered some benefit to the genes of the proto-dancers, but that mutualism could evolve gradually, out of a commensal or even parasitic relationship, as competing memes fought for time in the available bodies. Infectious bad habits can be hard to eradicate, but if they can morph into useful habits, their reproductive prospects are enhanced. Once recognized, at first dimly, Darwin's unconscious selection, and then consciously, Darwin's methodical selection, their reproduction would be more or less ensured by their hosts, so the memes could relax, become less exciting, less irresistible, less captivating, less vivid and unforgettable because they had become so useful. The brains of domesticated animals are always smaller than the brains of their nearest wild kin. Use it or lose it, and domesticated animals have a relatively unchallenging life, being protected from predators and starvation, and provided with mates at procreation time. The corollary of this, of course, is that for something boring to spread, it has to be deemed by its hosts to be particularly useful, or particularly valuable, and hence worth breeding, inculcating via extensive training. Double-entry bookkeeping and trigonometry come to mind. Being deemed valuable by influential hosts is itself a frequent adaptation among memes, and among the more extreme examples are soporific atonal serious music and some lineages of contemporary conceptual art that, like laying hens, are so domesticated that they would go extinct in a generation without the assistance of their well-heeled stewards. So even if it is true, as Richardson and Boyd and Sperber and others have noted, that many important areas of human culture exhibit change over time, that is not just a direct effect of high-fidelity transmission systems of discrete, gene-like informational entities. Such systems, not only words but music, dance, crafts, and other traditions of affordances, provide a variety of paths that can carry cultural information from generation to generation with enough fidelity for relatively mindless gradual mutation to accumulate improvements with minimal comprehension required. And, as we heard in the case of the canoes, artifacts themselves provide norms of correction. As a general rule of thumb, any artifact found in abundance and showing signs of use is a good whatever it is. Following this rule, you can often tell the good ones from the not-so-good ones without knowing exactly why the good ones are good. Copy the good ones, of course. Darwin's brilliant idea of unconscious selection as the gradualist segue into domestication gets put to important use in cultural evolution as well. our ancestors automatically ignored the runts of the litter and the lemons of the fleet, and the result in each case was the gradual improvement, relative to human tastes and needs, of the offspring. Memes, unlike genes, don't have competing alleles at a locus. The way genes are represented in DNA is as long sequences of nucleotides, A, C, G, T, which make it possible to compare different genomes and identify the places, loci, where they are alike and where they differ. There is nothing like this yet in the physical representation of memes. There is no common underlying code for representing a particular meme or its competition wherever their tokens occur. For instance, Benjamin Franklin invented bifocals, and no doubt had some neural structures in his brain that embodied or represented his brainchild, the concept of bifocals. When he publicized his invention, others picked up the idea, but there is no good reason to suppose the neural structures in their brains spelled the bifocals concept the same way he did. For some critics, this is tantamount to admitting that there is no bifocal meme, that memes don't exist, that meme theory is a bad idea. For one thing, it means that we can't use a common code to identify loci in different brains and see if, at the bifocals locus, there is the same or a different spelling of the meme, the way genetic testing can reveal if you have the allele variant for Huntington's chorea or Tay-Sachs disease. But as we have seen, there are alphabetic systems for words, music, and many other families of memes, and they create roles or pigeonholes or loci for somewhat different sorts of allelic competition. In words, there are competitions between pronunciation, controversy, data, and foreign word borrowings often exhibit a competition between an approximation of the foreign pronunciation and a more rudely naturalized version. You can have some au juice on your beef au jus, while a French chaise longue becomes an American chaise lounge, and lingerie, roughly, evolves into lingerie. Or we can hold pronunciation constant and look at competing meanings at a phonological locus. There are the opposite meanings of terrific and incredible, where the negative senses are almost extinct, and homely, which has come to have hugely different meanings on opposite sides of the Atlantic. For a while, beg the question was hanging on to its original technical meaning in philosophy and logic, but most, of its tokens today mean raise the question, roughly. This meaning is now issuing from the mouths and pens of influential authors, so the charge of misuse is beginning to sound pedantic and antiquarian. As with genes, mutations are transmission errors. But on occasion, such an error is a serendipitous improvement. What started out as a bug has become a feature. Then there are cases like skyline, which originally meant the line in a visually perceivable scene that demarcates the terrestrial from the sky, subverbo OED, but has imperceptibly shrunk to urban applications only. Richard, forthcoming. A mountain ridge scene in the wilderness is no longer aptly called a skyline. Or we can hold meaning constant and look at semantic loci where the war of the synonyms is waged, with regional strongholds and nostalgia-inducing antique terms on their way to obsolescence. A soda or soft drink was a tonic in my 1950s Massachusetts neighborhood, and a milkshake was a frap. It is not that these shifts in meaning and pronunciation, and grammar too, went unnoticed until memes came along. In fact, they have been studied rigorously for several centuries by historical linguists and others. But these scholars have sometimes been hobbled by presumptions about essential meanings, creating artifactual controversies that look strikingly like the taxonomists' battles over species, genera, varieties, and subspecies that relaxed after Darwin came along. The word incredible really means unbelievable, of course. Just look at its etymology. Yes, and birds are really dinosaurs, and dogs are really wolves. In music, we can look at each popular song as a locus, with the covers by different bands duking it out for domination. From this perspective, we can see that often the hit version of a song, which goes nearly to fixation, is a mutation, a rival allele of the originally released version. Some singer-songwriters are well known for having their original versions supplanted by later covers. Have you ever heard Kris Kristofferson's original version of Me and Bobby McGee? They still get royalties on the other singers' versions, even if the value added by later interpreters earns them the lion's share of record sales. Here, the existence of the technology of sound recording provides fixed, canonical versions of a song, hardening the physical identity of each version. Experiments by Daniel Levitin used this regularity to test human subjects on their memory for pitch and tempo of popular songs. Whereas Greensleeves has no canonical pitch, key, or tempo, Hey Jude and Satisfaction do. And fans of these records were surprisingly good at humming or singing these songs from memory with close to the right pitch and tempo. When we consider whether memes are replicated faithfully enough to permit the accumulation of adaptations, we should include the enhancing technology and culture just as we do with genes. A lot of evolutionary R&D went into improving the replication machinery of DNA during the first billion or so years of life. The invention of writing has similarly boosted the fidelity of linguistic transmission, and it was the product of many minds in many places over several millennia. Few, if any, of the inventors of writing had, or needed to have, a clear vision of the specs of the machine they were inventing, the problem they were solving so elegantly. Compare their work to Turing inventing the computer or the top-down designing of the elevator controller program. As noted in Chapter 6, copyright requires the existence of a relatively permanent record, writing or audio recording, for obvious evidential reasons. But the ability to translate or transduce an invention into such a medium has a more profound impact than mere legal protection. The written medium allows more complexity because the words on a page don't die on the air like speech, but can be rescanned until you figure out what the writer intended. This gives us the ability to offload a key phrase or sentence, or verse or saga or promulgation, into the world, taking a burden off our limited working memory and allowing us to take our time going over and over a bit of text without worrying about whether it will slowly morph in our rehearsals or dissolve from our memory altogether. It is possible, with much practice, to do three-digit multiplication in your head, but think how much easier it is with a pencil and a scrap of paper. Thanks to further innovations, we may now be on the verge of a major transition in cultural evolution. There is no DNA for culture now, but HTML, the underlying language of content representation on the Internet, or its descendants, may become so dominant in the future that few memes can compete for eyeballs and ears in this crowded world of information without getting themselves represented in HTML. There are now bots and apps that can search for content and recognize or discriminate content, such as Shazam, the smartphone app. If their descendants begin making what amount to value judgments, what Richardson and Boyd call biased transmission, encouraging the differential replication of memes without any reliance on human brains, eyes, or ears, then the memes of the near future may thrive without direct human intervention, still synanthropic, like barn swallows and chimney swifts, but dependent on the amenities of the technological niche constructed in the 21st century by human beings. These digitally copied memes had been called teams by Susan Blackmore, but she has more recently decided to call them treams. More on them in the final chapter. Not all processes of change in culture exhibit features analogous to competition of alleles at loci. But that feature is, in any case, just one of the dimensions along which evolutionary processes can vary, some more Darwinian than others. Darwin didn't have the concept of a locus with alleles, and he didn't need it to establish in general outline his theory of evolution by natural selection. We'll examine some of the other dimensions of variation arrayed on one of Godfrey Smith's Darwinian spaces in Chapter 13. Memes add nothing to what we already know about culture. The claim is that the would-be mimeticist has simply taken over wholesale all the categories, discovered relationships and phenomena already well described and explained by cultural theorists of more traditional, non-biological schools of thought, and rebranded the whole enterprise as mimetics. According to this objection, there is no value added by switching from idea talk and belief talk and tradition talk and institution talk to meme talk, with its pseudo-biological, pseudo-scientific sheen. Where are the novel insights, the corrections, the clarifications that might motivate or warrant such an imperialistic takeover? At best, mimeticists are reinventing the wheel. I hope I have done justice to the adamant outrage with which this objection is often expressed. There is some truth to this charge, and in particular mimeticists, myself included, have on occasion offered presumed novel insights to traditional cultural theorists that they had long ago formulated and digested. It must be particularly irritating for a culture theorist, a historian or anthropologist or sociologist, for instance, to endure an elementary mimetics-based explanation of some phenomenon that unwittingly echoes some much more detailed and supported explanation they had authored some years earlier. It would be shocking to discover that earlier cultural theorists were all wrong in their theories, or that they had been blind to all the distinctions noted by mimeticists, so it should not embarrass the mimeticist to acknowledge that, in some regards, culture theorists had gotten along quite well in their explanatory projects without mimetics. In fact, mimeticists should seek out and treasure the insights garnered by traditional investigators of culture following the good example of Darwin, who harvested the wealth of natural history he learned from his large coterie of correspondence. The data gathered and tabulated on all aspects of plants and animals by pre-Darwinian investigators had the seldom-sung virtue of being theoretically untainted, not gathered by ardent Darwinians or ardent anti-Darwinians, whose biases might cloud their judgment. And non-Darwinian pre-mimetics studies and theories of culture should be valued for the same reason. The data gathering, always at risk of being tainted by observer bias in the social sciences, has at least not been gathered with intent to support mimetics. Mimetics would be a dubious candidate for a good theory of cultural evolution if it didn't take over large swaths of earlier theory, making minor terminological adjustments by recasting the points in meme talk. But mimetics should also offer genuine advances in outlook, and I have already sketched what I take to be its main contributions, along with the corresponding weaknesses in traditional theories of culture. Cultures are full of well-designed elements, and traditional theorists of culture have either over-endowed people with comprehension, with inventive skill, with genius, or, seeing that people like butterflies, like antelopes, can be beneficiaries of arrangements that they needn't understand, have simply abdicated the responsibility of accounting for how the requisite R&D might have come to pass. Genetic evolution, instincts, can't operate fast enough to do the job, leaving a yawning gap to be filled by mimetics, and no positive ideas of anything else coming from traditional approaches to culture that could do the job. The mimetics perspective is also valuable in depsychologizing the spread of innovations, good and bad. Traditional approaches to cultural evolution, in the neutral sense of cultural change over time, such as history of ideas and cultural anthropology, take people to be, in the first place, perceivers, believers, rememberers, intenders, knowers, understanders, noticers. A comatose or sleeping person is not a transducer-transmitter of culture under any conditions. So the natural assumption is that cultural innovations are noticed and then, often, adopted. The innovations are typically held to have been adopted because they were appreciated or valued or just desired. They may be adopted by mistake, of course. This all fits smoothly, too smoothly, with the default vision of people as rational agents, intentional systems whose behavior can be predicted in principle by attributing beliefs, desires, and rationality to them. This in turn yields one version or another of the economic model of cultural preservation and transmission. Those cultural goods deemed valuable are preserved, maintained, and either bequeathed to the next generation or sold to the highest bidder. But much cultural innovation happens by what might be called subliminal adjustments over long stretches of time, without needing to be noticed or consciously approved at all. Like viruses, memes can spread from host to host without the hosts taking notice. Population-level effects can accumulate unheeded by the members of the population. These accumulated shifts can often be recognized in retrospect, as when an expatriate community is joined by a new person from the old country whose way of speaking is both strangely familiar and strangely unfamiliar. Aha, I remember, we used to talk like that too. Not just pronunciation and word meaning can subliminally shift. In principle, attitudes, moral values, the most emblematic idiosyncrasies of a culture can soften, harden, erode, or become brittle at a pace too slow to perceive. Cultural evolution is lightning fast compared to genetic evolution, but it can also be much too gradual for casual observation to discern. Then there are the pathological cultural variants. Many persistent cultural phenomena are maladaptive, and no theory that aligns cultural innovations with genetic innovations, adaptations transmitted by other means, has any way of accounting for these. Richardson and Boyd's chapter, Culture is Maladaptive, is not presented as a defense of memetics, but it adopts the memetic perspective to account for a variety of otherwise puzzling phenomena, such as the thriving, so far, of Anabaptists such as the Amish. They grant, in spite of their misgivings about some aspects of memes, that the selfish meme effect is quite robust. So far, only the Anabaptists and a few similar groups, like ultra-Orthodox Jews, seem to have much resistance to modernity's infections. Anabaptism is like a tightly made kayak navigating the turbulent modernist sea. It looks so fragile, but survives because it doesn't leak despite the enormous stresses it faces. One serious cultural leak anywhere, and it's gone. Anabaptism's evolutionary future or futures are impossible to predict. In the meantime, you can't help but admire the beauty of the design. The would-be science of memetics is not predictive. In one sense, this is true, but not an objection. The theory of genetic evolution is also not predictive in the sense that it permits us to describe what the future of H. sapiens, or codfish, or polar bears, or spruce trees, will be with any degree of certainty. There is a deep reason for this. Darwinian evolutionary processes are amplifiers of noise. As I noted in Chapter 1, a curious feature of evolution by natural selection is that it depends crucially on events that almost never happen. So, evolutionary theory, not being able to predict the once-in-a-billion events that in due course get amplified into new species, new genes, new adaptations, can't predict the future except very conditionally. If such and such happens, then, unless some other unpredictable event gets amplified into a clobberer, such and such will happen. But this sort of real-time prediction is not a necessary requirement for serious science. prediction of what we will and won't find if we dig for fossils, to take an obvious case, is still prediction, even though it's ultimately about events that occurred millions of years ago. Evolutionary biology predicts that you will never find a bird with fur instead of feathers, no matter how isolated it is on some faraway island, and that you will find quite specific DNA sequences in quite specific places in the genomes of any heretofore unknown insect that is captured anywhere in the world. So the fact that mimeticists cannot reliably say which songs will make the top 20 or whether hemlines will rise in 2017 is not a serious objection to a science of mimetics. A better question is whether mimetics can provide unified explanations of patterns that have been recorded by earlier researchers of culture, but not unified or explained at all. I have claimed that the meme's eye view fills the large and awkward gap between genetically transmitted instincts and comprehended inventions, between competent animals and intelligent designers. And it fills it with the only kind of theoretical framework that can non-miraculously account for the accumulation of good design, differential replication of descendants. Whether some other evolutionary theory of cultural change can fill this gap remains to be seen. Memes can't explain cultural features, while traditional social sciences can. This objection misses the point of memes, as we can see by mounting a similar objection to genes. Genes can't explain adaptations, structures, organs, instincts, etc. That's true. That's why we need molecular biology, physiology, embryology, ethology, island biogeography, and all the other specializations of biology if we are going to explain how particular adaptations work and why they are adaptations. We also need these other fields to explain how parasites exploit their hosts, how spider webs are cost-effective food traps, how beavers build their dams, why whales vocalize, and all the rest. Similarly, we need psychology, anthropology, economics, political science, history, philosophy, and literary theory to explain how and why cultural features, good and bad, work the way they do. Theodosius Dobzhansky was right when he so quotably said, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." But he didn't say that the light of evolution makes sense of everything in biology. There is nothing in mimetics that can replace the hard-won data gathering and pattern proving of the behavioral ecology of people in music and the arts, religions, corporations, armies, clubs, families, teams, schools, kitchens, and all the other contexts of human life. What mimetics promises to do is provide the framework for making sense of all this in some of its aspects. Nobody is born a priest or a plumber or a prostitute, and how they got that way is not going to be explained by their genes alone or just by the memes that infest them. Pre-Darwinian natural history at its best was well-developed, systematic science, with hypotheses to test and explanations galore. But Darwin enriched it with a host of questions that put all its generalizations in a new light. My overarching claim in this book is that the evolutionary perspective in general and the mimetic perspective with regard to culture transform many of the apparently eternal puzzles of life, that is, meaning and consciousness, in ways inaccessible to those who never look beyond the manifest image that they grew up with and the disciplines they are trained in. Cultural evolution is Lamarckian. This is one of the most popular explanations of why Darwinian approaches to cultural evolution are misguided, and it wears its confusion and desperation on its sleeve. Presumably, what those who make this charge have in mind is the doctrine most famously advanced by Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, a predecessor of Darwin, according to which characteristics acquired by an individual organism in its lifetime can be transmitted genetically to its offspring. The blacksmith's bulging biceps, acquired by strenuous use, are passed on to his progeny through his genes, not through his enforcement of rigorous exercise habits in his children. Similarly, on this Lamarckian view, the fear of human beings inculcated in a dog as a result of having an encounter with a cruel master can become an instinctual fear in the dog's puppies, which never have to experience cruelty to anticipate and fear it. Not so. There is no way for an acquired trait to adjust an organism's genes so that the trait gets passed along to the next generation genetically. The organism's body would have to reverse engineer the somatic, bodily, change and work out what the genetic recipe for making that novelty and normal development would be, and then revise the DNA sequence in the sperm or eggs accordingly. This truly heretical idea was not only espoused by Lamarck, but variations on it were also quite popular in the 19th century. Darwin was tempted by a version of it, but it is indeed discredited in standard neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory. There are various real phenomena that look rather Lamarckian because they do involve something like the transmission of acquired characteristics to offspring, but not genetically. For instance, a fearful dog might well transmit fear to her puppies through a pheromone, the smell of fear, or via a hormone she shared through the placenta, but not through her genes. There's also the Baldwin effect, which looks Lamarckian in some regards, since behaviors acquired by one generation can create a selection pressure favoring offspring who have a heightened tendency or talent for acquiring that behavior, eventually making it instinctual. And then there are the current hot topics, the complexities of development uncovered by evo-devo biologists, including especially epigenetic traits. A consensus definition of an epigenetic trait was achieved in 2008. A stably heritable phenotype resulting from changes in a chromosome without alterations in the DNA sequence. The topics are hot for several reasons. The researchers have uncovered some fascinating new wrinkles at the molecular level in the unfolding saga of evolutionary theory. Some of the researchers have trumpeted their discoveries as truly revolutionary, calling into question neo-Darwinian orthodoxy. And as a result, Darwin dreaders outside biology have perked up their ears, inflated what they've heard, and spread the false alarm that evolution by natural selection has been refuted by the discovery of Lamarckian inheritance. Nonsense. Presumably, certain critics of memes operate under the impression that if cultural evolution is Lamarckian, then it cannot be Darwinian. Phew! The critics are right that cultural transmission permits any traits that are acquired by the parent to be inculcated in the young, by setting an example, by training, by admonition. But this does not show that cultural evolution is not accomplished by Darwinian natural selection. Far from it. After all, parents can also pass on their acquired germs and microbes and viruses to their young, and all of these phenomena are uncontroversially subject to non-Lamarckian Darwinian natural selection. Maybe these critics are forgetting that in mimetic evolution, it is the fitness of the memes themselves that is at stake, not the fitness of their hosts. The question of Lamarckianism should be whether features acquired by the memes can be transmitted to their offspring. And here, since the genotype-phenotype distinction that makes Lamarckian transmission all but impossible is absent, Lamarckian transmission would not be a heresy, but just an alternative variety of natural selection. After all, memes don't have genes. In a virus, for instance, there is no clear distinction between germline mutation and acquired trait. The replicator and the interactor are, for most purposes, one and the same thing. There is another, more interesting way cultural evolution might be considered Lamarckian, and it is easiest to see if we consider our paradigm memes words. As we heard in Chapter 9, before an infant will begin trying to imitate a word, it has to have heard about 6 tokens, 6 parents, not the usual 2, or 1 in the case of asexually reproducing organisms. But suppose I, as an adult, learn a new word, hearing you say it in a context that makes it clear what it means. I store a copy of your token as a new lexical item in my brain. The informational structure in my head is a descendant of your token, and every time I rehearse it, these newly made tokens are further descendants, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, in effect, of the single token you uttered. But suppose before I utter the word aloud, I hear you say it again, or hear it on the lips of several other speakers. Now I have multiple models for my new word, multiple parents, in effect. We might then consider that my new word, like the infant's, has multiple parents that all contributed to fixing the informational structure descended from them. Or we might consider the first utterance heard the sole parent, just like a virus, which reproduces asexually, and consider all the other tokens that helped fix the stable features of my version of the word to be not parents, but just influencers. After all, having heard the first token from you, my memory and perceptual system is set up to recognize further tokens. And when I hear the later tokens from others, this may induce me to make further tokens of my own. But this won't be imitating the others. It will be triggered reproduction. But triggering reproduction is itself, if not a parenting, at least a bit of midwifery, making a contribution, and perhaps a biased contribution, to the further reproduction of the type. My informational structure for the word may be adjusted by encountering these later tokens of the word, and these could lead to changes in features that could then be inherited by any further offspring of my version. This would be Lamarckism of a sort at the meme level, one of many possible variants of natural selection in Darwinian populations. Alternatively, we could consider words, and memes more generally, to be the result of variable, temporally extended processes of reproduction, as if father's contribution was not made at conception but at some later time after mother had already given birth, an imaginable variation on our normal mode of sexual reproduction. So there are several ways we could consider a cultural evolution to be Lamarckian without thereby erecting a barrier against the imperialistic forays of dread Darwinism into the sacred precincts of culture. Steven Pinker, no friend of memes, has candidly acknowledged, "To say that cultural evolution is Lamarckian is to confess that one has no idea how it works." He goes on, however, to say quite a bit about how he thinks it works. "The striking features of cultural products, namely their ingenuity, beauty, and truth, analogous to organisms' complex adaptive design, come from the mental computations that direct, that is, invent, the mutations, and that acquire, that is, understand, the characteristics." This perfectly expresses the traditional view that it is comprehension by inventors, by intelligent designers, that accounts for the improvements, the ingenuity, beauty, and truth we observe in cultural items. Yes, some of the marvels of culture can be attributed to the genius of their inventors, but much less than is commonly imagined, and all of it rests on the foundations of good design built up over millennia by uncomprehending hosts of memes competing with each other for rehearsal time in brains. Several themes emerge from this consideration of objections to memes. First, the issue should not be whether Dawkins, when introducing the concept, managed to articulate the best definition, or whether I or anybody else has yet succeeded in coming up with a bulletproof formulation. The issue is, as it usually is in science, whether there are valuable concepts and perspectives emerging from the explorations to date. The analogy with genes is rich but partial, and perhaps the chief benefit of the meme's eye point of view is that it suggests questions about cultural phenomena that we might not otherwise think of asking, such as, is X the result of intelligent design? Is X a good worth preserving and bequeathing, or a bit of parasitic junk? Are there alternatives, alleles, to X that have been encountered and vanquished? Second, memes are in competition with traditional accounts of cultural change only when those accounts attribute comprehension to people or mysterious social forces for which there is no evidence other than the excellence of the designs. Thus, as we will find out in Chapter 13, the mimetic perspective provides a level playing field where all degrees and kinds of human comprehension can be located. There is not yet a formalized science of mimetics, and there may never be, though various pioneering forays have been attempted. But then, the parts of evolutionary theory in biology that have blossomed under mathematical treatments are only parts, and Darwin managed without any of them. Darwin also wisely postponed inquiry into how evolution got started until he had carefully described its mid-course operation, descent with modification. Following his lead, now that we have seen how words and other memes can descend with modifications from their ancestors, we can return to the difficult question of how cultural evolution in general and language in particular originated in our species.